Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Margaret O'Reilly, author of Humble Servant of Truth, a novel based on the life of Thomas Aquinas, an Italian friar who was canonized as a saint in 1323 and is known as one of the great philosophers of the Western world for his work blending natural reason and speculative theology. Thank you for coming, Margaret.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to start with asking people, why does Thomas Aquinas matter to us today?
Okay, I was thinking about that. I think it matters the same way that you would say the Pythagorean theorem matters in math, you know, because truth matters. You know, if somebody discovers some truth, it's important later, too. It's not just important at the time that he found it. So I think that the things that Thomas Aquinas figured out with his incredible mind are helpful to those of us who maybe wouldn't see it otherwise, wouldn't know. And then later philosophers and theologians can build off of that.
That's great. I agree. Can you, perhaps, for those who don't know a lot about, because I just summarized it myself so quickly, what is his brilliance? What is the thing that he came to that we are continually chewing on and learning more?
Yes, I understand that. There's so much. I think, where do you begin? I mean, even as a child, he was interested in God. He wanted to know, what is God? From the beginning, it was a question that, you know, puzzled him, and he had no doubt that there was God, and he had a kind of a love for this God, but he didn't know what exactly it is. Eventually he came to see so much and about God, and he realized not only is God good and God loves us and God made us, but we can know that God exists just with our reason, that it's something that pagan philosophers came to without any input from faith. And so he wanted to kind of develop that intellectual side, I think, to show the world and himself, you know, what God is, and that he is, that he really does exist. And even apart from that, I mean, there were other questions. That was the big question, I think, or the thing that people remember him for. He has these proofs for the existence of God that philosophers can really bite into and come to that understanding of God. But there were other questions that he dealt with, like the existence of the human soul. That, too, was something that Aristotle, who was a pagan philosopher, delved into and really came to some good solutions to that question. And Aquinas picked up that and wanted to show the world how, you know, that we do have an individual soul that's immortal, that goes on beyond our own earthly existence.
How did his childhood influence the kind of work, of course, the religious aspect of his life? How did that come to him?
I think he was born into a very devout family, although they were also very practical and very prominent in their social setting. His father was a knight. He was surrounded with counts, people who were important in that world. But they were devout Catholics, devoted to the Holy Father. And his education, then his upbringing, was in the church. When he was 5 years old, they sent him to school with the Benedictine fathers, and it was well suited to him. It suited his temperament. He had this inquisitiveness, which was able to be addressed there in school. So that was definitely influential in his life. Then, when he was a little bit older, the monastery had to close because of the political influences at that time. So he was encouraged to move on in education. There was a school in Naples that the emperor was responsible for. So he was encouraged to go there and further his studies. And the world of academia took note of him pretty much right away. Mm-hmm. He loved it. He loved what he was learning. And I think always in the back of his mind was his faith. So even, you know, studying the grammar and the Latin and the logic and all that, it was all kind of a way to get further into the truths that he really cared about. So I think it was just sort of surrounding him always in his life.
And the idea that he had the ability, because of his family, to go to such an education and to be dedicated to that.
So true, yes. Yeah, so probably God had a plan from the beginning for him and put him in that setting.
He put him in the right place.
Yes,
at the
exactly,
right time.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yes.
So what were the relationships in his life that really fueled him?
There were many influences, like in all our lives, I think. Mm-hmm. His family was very influential. He was devoted to his family. There were mentors, I think, all along the way. He had Benedictine fathers who cared about him in his early life. He went on and met the Dominicans when he went to Naples, some of the earlier Dominicans, right after the order had been started.
Oh.
And they were very influential in his life, more because he was impressed with how good they were. And then I think later, once he was into the world of academics, Albert the Great was a huge influence in his life. Albert was well-known in the academic world. He had a great mind. He was interested in everything, and everyone respected him. He's one of the few people I've run into who was called the Great during his lifetime.
That's true. I said Alexander the Great, and that was all for killing people,
right.
So it really isn't very useful.
That's right. I'm sure he had his place, too. But to be recognized for that greatness, I think he was probably, I imagine him as very outgoing, very impressive. And Aquinas was very shy around him, reticent, but Albert the Great recognized his brilliance and fostered it, I think, and wanted to encourage him. And so that was, I think, very important in Aquinas' life, a very important influence. And so he kind of pushed him forward. He brought him in. He helped form him. They worked together on questions and dealing with Aristotle. And then he urged him on the University of Paris, told him it was time to go and time to, you know, spread his wings. And even though he was not himself sure that he was ready, Albert was sure he was ready.
You need someone like that
yes.
to move you forward,
yes,
to,
get, exactly.
to let you trust yourself.
Exactly, right.
And it's also nice when someone like that doesn't want to sort of hoard your knowledge
yes,
for their work.
But to share it. Exactly. Right. That is something I think that was very motivating in Thomas's life and in Albert's. And in so many of these amazing good people, was that they cared not just about themselves or their careers or what they could do for themselves, but they cared about people, about others. They wanted to bring this good that they had to other people.
That's exactly right, in many of the stories that are part of this
yes,
series.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, that's true. So I have to ask you, what was your impression of St. Thomas before you began to research and write about him?
Well, I think ever since I was young, I'd heard the name. I knew that he was brilliant, but I didn't know. How?
Why?
Right. And then in college, I did study some St. Thomas, but I was a young learner, so I understood his arguments and his conclusions, and I had perfect confidence that that was there, but I wouldn't say I was a philosopher, a theologian myself, just sort of impressed with it, and I saw much of what he was saying in what I read. In reading, in doing all the research for this book, I saw another side of St. Thomas that I had not really seen. I knew that he had been called the dumb ox because he was quiet.
Right.
But I
How
saw...
Mean.
Yes. I think it was meant to be complimentary in a kind of twisted way. I saw that kind of gentleness and love that kind of emanated from him and was really a part of him that I had no idea of when I was studying his work. Also, I mean, on a more intellectual side, a lot of his work is very clear and simple. These are difficult questions, but he puts them very simply. And in reading about his life, I realized that that was something he really worked for. He really wanted it to be clear because he wanted the simple learners to be able to follow and to really come to these conclusions that are important, like the immortality of the soul and that God exists. So those were things. I think his genuine concern for others and his gentle, personable love of people.
Nature.
Yes.
What sort of research did you involve yourself in? Do we have letters? Do we have other biographies?
Right,
but...
yes. There was one book I used. Now I'm not going to be able to remember the title of it, but it was so helpful to me. What it was it went through his works, Aquinas' works, and explained what he was talking about, and this was by a man who clearly understood the philosophy and the theology well. So he would look at a work and say what Aquinas was trying to do there and exactly what, you know, the main points were he was bringing out and why. So that was a very helpful book to me. Chesterton, was helpful. I read Chesterton right away, The Dumb Ox, I think it's called, just to get a sense of it, the faith and reason idea. Mm-hmm. So Chesterton wasn't concrete in a lot of things, I thought, but it was very helpful to give an overview of why Aquinas is important, of bringing together that, or the compatibility, I guess, of faith and reason.
That makes sense.
Yes.
So when we think about when you were doing all this research, besides The Dumb Ox, which is pretty fun, but wasn't a new thing, what's something that you discovered that was unexpected or you found great joy in finding?
I think every work that I looked at, I found insights into the man, you know, and not just the work, but little things. I read some of the testimony from when he was being considered for canonization, mm-hmm. which was not long after his life, so that they could interview people who actually knew him and people who knew people who knew him.
Right.
So pretty fairly direct. And just thrown in here and there, I saw just insights into what kind of a person he was, how he cared for his family and how much he cared for his friends and, you know, his shyness. And it just comes out in all those kind of more abstract works. You would just see these little vignettes of his life. And they were fun.
Which is one of those that you used to create a particular scene, because we're taking real history, we're fictionalizing it to an extent. There are some spaces we understand we don't have a direct discussion of what happened at that moment.
Yes.
So is there a scene that you wrote that you particularly enjoyed creating based on some knowledge that you'd found?
Yes, I'm sure there are many. I think the ending keeps coming into my head. I'm sure there are others that probably would illustrate what you're talking about. But in the ending, he's dying, and he feels bad because he's staying in an abbey, a Cistercian abbey, because that's near where he became so ill. That was near. And so these brothers are taking care of him, and he feels bad because he feels like they're wasting their time. They should be doing much more important things than just taking care of this dying man.
No.
So he asks, isn't there something that I can do to pay you back in some way? And they ask him to write a commentary while he's on his deathbed on the Book of Solomon, which he does, but that's been lost, so none of us gets to see what it was.
Oh, no.
Then at the very end, there's just two things. When his confessor comes in to hear his last confession and walks out crying and says he had the sins of a 5-year-old, which is definitely your impression through reading about his life. This is a good man from beginning to end. Wow. And that was his whole life confession, not just through the last few weeks, but everything. Because he knows he's going to meet God.
Right.
So that was amazing. And then I think it's so telling when the abbot, I think it is, walks in with the Eucharist for the last time. And Thomas is really at the end, but he lifts himself up on his bed when he sees the Eucharist. And he's so moved because he knows this is God and this is who he has served all his life. And it's a beautiful scene. It's worth reading.
Just a beautiful moment. Exactly.
Yes.
I deeply enjoyed that because it was also very heartfelt. I could feel that the author, you were in that moment writing it.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Often, I mean, throughout the book, the best lines are the ones that are quotes. I definitely feel that. The longer quotes are so good.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But that's the way I feel what's interesting about these books is we're taking these the word character is not correct, but you know what I'm saying, that people, again, have heard their names, but haven't stopped and studied them, and giving them a chance to know them as humans, so they want to go and know more and more about their work.
Yes, exactly. And so it's kind of you're kind of a vehicle to get the stories and the passages, you know, to give them a context so that people who aren't familiar with it can see why he said this thing that we all know he said.
Exactly. I think that's to me the purpose of the books, and that's what they seem to be serving as I see them move out into the world and hear people's reflections.
Yes.
So what in your background set you up particularly, do you think, to write this book?
I would say my college education more than anything else. Mm-hmm. We study St. Thomas here. St. Thomas is revered.
So you attended St. Thomas?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So this was my college. It didn't look like this when I was going, though, because it's been in process. We studied St. Thomas with respect throughout the 4 years, and especially in the latter years. The earlier years at this school, you are kind of building up a foundation so that when you get to studying St. Thomas, you know what he's talking about. You have some of the background necessary, some of the philosophy that he leans on to go further. So that was definitely disposing me towards this topic. I think being a Catholic, any Catholic would be interested and respectful of Aquinas, because so much of what we know as Catholics, he clarified for us. So I think those are probably the two main things, my own college education and my faith.
Makes perfect sense. What, when you look at his life, what do you think was the one or two of the grander themes that ran through his life?
I think one of the main themes is the compatibility of faith and reason. I think maybe because when he was little, he wanted to know what is God, and that is in a way a matter of faith, but in a way a matter of reason. And I think because he had such a powerful intellect, he wanted to see and then to teach the way, the reasons that he saw for the things that he believed. And so, some of the things we believe, and actually his Summa Contra Gentiles is part of its purpose, was to show what we know through reason about our faith and what we accept on faith but can treat as reasonable. So I think that compatibility of faith and reason is definitely a theme in all his work and all his life.
And that matches perfectly. So who was he surrounded by in his later life? Obviously he left his family to go work. Did he travel lecturing as much, or was it mostly with the group that he was with teaching?
Well, he was a Dominican, so he was with Dominicans, but in different places. He traveled an amazing amount. I'm flabbergasted at the amount of traveling those men did on foot.
Yes, that's
yes.
true.
So I'll go to Paris. That's, you know, what is it, 1,000 miles over the Alps? Because they need me there, and then come back to Naples. And he did travel a bit, but I think he spent most of his working time in Paris. But first he went there as a student, and then he went back there to teach. And then he went back to Naples for a while, and then different things. He was lecturer for different popes along the way. He did teach for a while, just really young seminarians in Rome. And then he went back to Paris again because they were having some struggles in the academic world there, and he was hoping to help sort that out, which he actually contributed a great deal towards sorting it out, although it wasn't all recognized at the time, you know.
Ah.
But eventually people
so
saw
how
that.
Did
oh,
you
yes,
find that out? How
answer.
Did you figure out that it was eventually recognized?
I think that, well, for one thing, questions like the individuality of the human soul, things that, you know, I learned in catechism when I was, you know, in second grade.
Right.
That comes from the struggle they were having in Paris, just clarifying exactly what that was, the there were the Augustinists at the time who were good men, but they didn't think that each human individual has one individual soul. They thought that was just not consistent with our faith, I guess. I don't know, philosophically.
Well, that was their idea.
It worked out for them.
Right.
Yes. And then there were the Averroists there who thought that individuals do not have souls but participate in a universal soul, which is a common philosophical error. You hear it now all the time, right?
Right.
People
right.
fall into that. It's understandable. But I think the University of Paris was under the auspices of the church, and they were concerned. They wanted to have this stuff clarified because they wanted, you know, their people to learn the truth.
Correct, right, exactly.
So they wanted Thomas to come and sort of help clarify those on a philosophical level. So that's what he went back there. And so he spent many, many years in Paris teaching, and then with other little trips here and there.
So that means how many languages?
That is a good question.
How many languages
there
did
was a
speak?
Lot of Latin.
Because, I'm sure
you know,
that's
all
true.
The academic stuff, I believe, was in Latin.
True. So no matter where he
right.
traveled, he
right.
was already
right.
set
right.
up.
Right, right.
Very true.
I don't really know the answer to the question, but I imagine he knew any language he needed to know. There's this scene where he is dictating, I don't know how many different texts to different people. He was working on the Gaetana Aurea, which is a commentary on the Gospels, and he was working on the many commentaries on Aristotle and on his Summa Theologica all at the same time. So imagine him in a room like this, a big room, with these different secretaries and telling them, you know, what we want to say on this question, what we want to say on that question, to the different ones, and also citing, that was interesting to me, citing his texts and resources, as he went along, without picking up a book, which is what I would have to do in finding the page, he would say, well, you remember, as St. Chrysostom said in whatever document. And then they would check before they would, you know, commit it to permanent writing, and he was always right. So he must have known other languages, too, but I'm not an expert in that question.
No, but that's a fascinating thought to go figure out.
Yeah.
Cool. We touched a little bit on who you consider his mentors, the major people in his life. Does parents play any part in that?
Yes. I get the sense that he was very much attached to his father. His mother was a strong woman with opinions, as far, you know, as it seems to me, about how her children should be brought up and what kinds of things were acceptable to do. And that affected him. I mean, that's why he went to the Benedictines, because they were a well-established order and maybe more socially acceptable.
Tied in.
Yes, exactly. So she had hopes that if he studied with the Benedictines, he might then move on to higher things, you know, first within the church. And then there, in the medieval Italy, at least, the church and the social world were very much connected. One could do well, if one did well in the church, one could do well in the social setting.
Exactly.
So she had those ideas. But it's clear that the faith was important to both his parents and his older sisters and brothers. His brothers were also very interested in doing well on the practical level.
Mm-hmm. How many siblings did he have?
Oh my goodness, I think it was 7.
Wow. Typical for the day. But.
Yes, right. He was the youngest surviving. In the book, it talks about the fact that his younger sister died as a child, as a baby.
Also typical, sadly.
Yes. Isn't that true?
Wow.
And so sad.
And he knew from a young age that he wanted to be in the church. He didn't want to marry.
It sounds like he did know that right away. And not, I mean, going off to study with the Benedictines didn't make that a foregone conclusion. Lots of people did that and then went on to careers or whatever.
Correct.
But he loved it. He loved it. He loved being just in the church and living that orderly life. He wanted to study, which he felt, and he loved the idea of that kind of poverty that the Dominicans had. So he shifted from the Benedictines to the Dominicans because of the idea of studying, giving his life to study and to that sense of poverty. The sense of poverty didn't appeal to his mother. She was more interested in the idea of wealth and success at first.
I can imagine for your children.
Right, exactly. Want them to do well and be well established, especially in a kingdom like that, where the emperor had so much power and really terrifying amount of power. If you weren't in his good graces, you really had reason to fear, especially if you were a prominent family as they were. The emperor would notice if you were not compatible or not sympathetic with
his ideas.
Yes, his ideas, exactly.
True.
Yes.
True. And yet it seems like in the end, St. Thomas was more successful in that he lived exactly the kind of life he wanted and he gave to others.
Yes.
And it wasn't about collecting things, it was about giving things.
Yes, I think that's exactly true. That he seemed to have a sense from the start of what he would be good at. There was a time when he had an opportunity, even as a Dominican, to go back and take over the abbacy, I guess, of the Benedictines. But he just knew. I mean, that would have been great for a lot of people. They would have said, this is a great opportunity for me. But he just knew that was not God's plan for him. And even at the end, when his friend is saying, I know they're going to make you a cardinal at this next council, I knew they are. He says, no, that is just not. He just knew. It was clear. That's what God wanted for him, and following that path had so much effect, so much good influence.
Beautiful. So, just briefly, by what rules were they able to canonize him?
I don't know that much about. I know the canonization process requires miracles. It requires investigating the life of the person to see that it really is as it seems.
Right.
And I know that they had zero problems when they investigated his life. They found what they expected to find. I don't know about the miracles. I'm not sure what they were.
Not a problem. That just came to the top of my head.
Yes,
I was like, I remember.
Good question. Legitimate. Another thing to look into.
Not a problem. Great. We'd love to end these interviews by asking all the authors, who then have been your mentors in life?
I have been blessed with many mentors. My parents, very influential in my early life. My education was not so great. The schools I went to were not so great. But my parents kind of guided me through that, paid very careful attention to what was going on in my school and set me straight. And then I think in college I had the most admirable tutors and influences on my life, priests, tutors, people who were so good that you could really admire and who I really felt knew, you know, that they understood, and it was, I was in good shape if I just followed their example and their advice and learned from them. So that was very influential for me. I just have always been surrounded by good people. But I think, of course, my faith and Jesus Christ is our best mentor. And you're always safe putting your trust and in guidance in him. And he has always been an influence in my life, too.
So it sounds like you've been very blessed.
Yes, very blessed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.